Hi. We're on. Any business? Housekeeping details? Questions? Good recipes. Okay. We have nearly finished grading exercise 2, and I think we can give you some feedback on that now. So Talia will talk about the first.
Read over your papers. There's still a lot of typos that I've been finding. And at the back of the syllabus, there's Larry's pet peeves, and I would highly suggest that you read over them and look into your papers to see if you have done any of those pet peeves, because I've been seeing a couple, like the I, me distinction when you're saying my friend and I, my friend and me, as well as continuing to look at your affect effect. And if I've made a mistake, please feel free to come to me, because reading so many papers with affect effect, I start to second guess myself. So I understand that I have I may make a mistake every now and then. So, but overall, I thought that the papers were really good, really well written, and some great examples. So that's it. I'll have them for you on Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you. I, on the other hand, never make a mistake. Right. But if you think I did, let me know. And I'll bluff my way out of it somehow. And I read the ones on the microsystem, and they also were interesting, and let me echo the appreciation we both have for the fact that people do use their personal examples and their personal situations, and I'm glad that the course allows us to do that, and also appreciate that we have the opportunity to learn a little bit about your lives, and appreciate that you trust us with those. It also makes reading them much more interesting than it would be if they were all impersonal. The difficulties that I've run into on these exercises, I realize, illustrate for me, or bring to my attention, the fact that I haven't in the book clarified as well as I would like to, the fact that we're talking about a pattern. So let me talk, some of you did and talked about the pattern, and let me suggest ways to make that description even more more analytic, more in depth. And I'm trying to add this now to the next draft of the book, so I appreciate your struggling with this and helping me struggle with how to make it clearer. As we think about the microsystem, it is the pattern of those three, the roles and the relationships. And the activities. So the first place to start, obviously, and most of you did, is to talk about the relationships and the roles and the activities within the particular setting. A few of you who tackled that, and if you remember from last week, Talia guessed that 10% of you would do that exercise. Actually, 20% of you did. Exactly 20%, so I got to read more than I expected to. They were fun. The difficulties, some of you had difficulty picking a particular setting and wandered around two or three different settings, but most of you didn't. Most of you picked one. A couple of you picked settings that are so complex that trying to describe the roles and relations and activities within it would be overwhelming and was. But they were interesting analyses, and it was interesting to see people wrestling with that large setting, community level setting, for example. So the first thing you have to do is pick the setting and then figure out who's in it, because that will determine what the relations are. So that's the first question. Who's here? What are the roles? What are the relations? What kinds of activities go on? So essentially that would be three lists. And who is in it might change over the course of a day or time. The roles might change over the course of a day or a week or whatever time period you've chosen. The relationships might change and the activities might change. So you have to be prepared for the lists to change, and that would be part of the pattern, the change over time. The piece that is missing in a few of them are that the relations, and remember, you always think about affect and thinking about a relation. What are you thinking about? Power, thank you. Affect, power, and reciprocity. Okay, so anytime you're trying to talk about a relation, it's important to think about affect, power, and reciprocity. And the interesting part of one of the interesting parts of the pattern is how the relationships differ when the roles differ. So, for example, if you're talking about a job situation, you have a boss, perhaps, you have a manager, you have the peons or the basic employees, you might have customers. Those are all different roles. And each of them includes a different kind of relation. Different power, perhaps, and different activities. So in a particular dyad, a particular relation, the nature of the relation, the affect, power, and reciprocity may depend on which roles are represented, and the activities will differ. The boss is going to relate to customers differently, the manager is going to relate to the employees differently than the manager relates to customers. There may be several different employees. They have relationships among each other, and you can see very quickly that it doesn't take many people to make a very complex pattern, particularly if there are different kinds of roles. So as you increase the number of roles, different roles within the microsystem, the possibility for different kinds of relationships changes. And the roles, of course, are related to specific kinds of activities, since customers do different things than employees, and they both do different things than bosses or managers. The list of activities depends on which relationship and which set of roles you're talking about. So a full description of that pattern would take into account the possible combinations of roles, each with its potentially different kind of relationship, and the relationships having different characteristics of affect, power, and reciprocity. So when you're describing a microsystem, you're describing the pattern of all three of those in their full complexity. To start with, then it's likely, and then it becomes interesting to see if that pattern changes over time. So we had an example in class on Wednesday that was also a class, an example in the exercise of a waitress in a restaurant whose roles and relationships change depending on how many customers there are. So that's a change in the pattern, and that's part of the microsystem. And it's important in that microsystem that when the place is busy, it's waitressing, and when the place is not busy, you can waitress and play the dual role of waitress and friend or daughter or whatever might be appropriate with a particular client, customer, patron. Okay? So over the course of the day, you can see the pattern changing as it becomes more or less busy, and perhaps your roles change. That particular example didn't include it, but what happens, for example, if you have a manager and two or three waitresses over the course of the day, but at 2 o'clock, the manager takes off to do personal errands. So the pattern changes because that person isn't there, but that person, the manager, delegates responsibility to one waitress. So that person acquires a different temporary role and different power in the relationships, different responsibilities. And then when the manager comes back, that role changes. So if it were not particularly busy when you were the when you were just the waitress, then you can change your role and relationships. But when you're the temporary person in charge, maybe you can't. So that's part of the pattern too. Does my role change when one person is gone, when a particular person is gone? Do my relationships change when I step into that particular role? Okay. So as you're looking at the pattern, trying to combine all three and the various combinations, and then looking at how it changes across time, and then thinking about whether that pattern, for example, across the day, is pretty consistent, or whether it changes dramatically. What's the degree of change in that pattern? Then when you get more complicated, and this you wouldn't need to do for the exercise, but it reminds me that when we're talking about the microsystem, going beyond what I wrote in the book to more appropriately capture what Bronfenbrenner's talking about, part of the issue is whether the microsystem is stable. Is it a routine? Does it do the same things over the course of the week, over the course of a month? Or is it unpredictable? Does it change? Does it change predictably, or does it change randomly? Can we tell why the microsystem changes? Does it have the same people playing the same roles all the time? Or is there a constant change in the personnel and therefore the relationships and perhaps the roles? Is one of the issues in a particular microsystem the fact that the role is played differently by different people who play the role? I can remember an example of a work situation I was in where you never knew who was going to be in charge week to week because they rotated managers in and out from other places. And each one had his or her own style, and you came in my case, Saturday, and you didn't know what you were going to face. It was a very interesting kind of work situation to be in. It's sort of, oh, who's in charge today? You knew who it was going to be, but it might have been somebody you'd never seen before, who'd never seen you, and now you're working for him. And you had to figure out pretty quickly what his style was. And some of them were idiots and didn't know the job and were drunk on power and existed to make the other employee's life miserable. And some of them were just wonderful and also didn't know the job, but they knew that and they would tell you that, so they would tell you to go on and do whatever it was you normally did, and they would try to stay out of your way. Those I liked. They had a valid view of themselves in the setting. Okay? So, you have a pattern, but what's interesting to us ecologically is how does that pattern change? And as we're trying to deal with a particular pattern, is it random? Is it predictable? Is it easy to adapt to? Is it not? And then, along with that, the bottom line gets to, is this a microsystem that facilitates the development of the people in it? And does that change over time? So it may be facilitating development for a while, and then it changes, the pattern changes in ways that become less facilitating of development. And it would be important ecologically and developmentally to be able to understand what was going on in the system that was making it less conducive to development. Or how could you change that microsystem so that it would become more conducive to development? Okay? So that exercise is very complex because the notion of microsystem is very complex if you're going to understand it in its full glory. And then, after you've understood it, then you can apply it to development by thinking about change over time and how a particular person might be playing a role in that particular microsystem. So, any questions about that? You didn't have to do all that to get 5 points. I didn't want to make it sound like you really blew this one. What really happened was that as I read it, I realized, I know this exercise is very complex. And when I went back and looked at the book and thought about the description of the microsystem and what I had said in lecture, there was room for a lot more. And you might have written the exercise more elaborately had I given you more direction about that. So I'm revising that section of the book. Thank you. That's what this course is about. Making my understanding of Bronfenbrenner better. So I appreciate that. I appreciate your contribution to my understanding. Any questions about it? Yes. I'm sorry? Yes. Yep. And Wednesday's exercise I'll review in just a minute. But are you picking up some similarity? Yeah, you are. I did too. And I hope that you would recognize that sort of the challenge at each level is parallel. It's analogous because this is a system in which the various components transact with each other in quite analogous ways. And as you get more familiar with Bronfenbrenner's system, you'll find yourself applying relationships and aspects of the system at one level to another level. And that's the way it ought to work. That's what makes it, for me, a powerful system, because I can use the same sorts of relationships at different levels. People relate somewhat similarly to the way settings relate to each other. Interesting. Any other questions? Anything you want to add to that, Talia? Okay. I'm safe for a minute. All right. Let's look at exercise three then, which is due Wednesday. And I talked briefly about this last week to get you started on it. I had several emails over the weekend, and I appreciate those checking out details of what the assignment requires. And as people were writing it, they ran into problems in understanding or applying a particular characteristic. So please feel free, anytime you're writing any of the exercises, to ask me. I tend to check my email several times a day, even on weekends. And I'm happy to try to respond. Okay, so in this case, you're picking three important settings. And the question then is not what's going on in those settings particularly, but how those settings are linked to each other. Describe the links between each pair of settings. So you have all the links that you find between setting A and B, B and C, and A and C. So you have three chunks. Okay. The links between A and B, the links between B and C, the links between A and C to describe. And then you have half a dozen of the hypotheses. And the task is to sort out what you think the hypothesis means. They're all hypotheses about the relationships between settings. So they're all about the mesosystem. And take them one at a time. Okay. So hypothesis 28, let me see if I know what that means. And then see if it applies to any of the pairs of settings that you have described the links for. So does hypothesis 28 fit here, or here, or there? Or does it not fit any of them? That's a possibility. That, well, it's not illustrated in any of these settings that I've chosen. And that's okay. But make sure that you've thought about the hypothesis carefully. Then do the same thing for 34. I mean, make sure I understand what the hypothesis is about, what it says about the relationships between settings. In my life, we're talking about your life, your settings, then does it apply, does it pertain to any of those pairs? And it might pertain to one or two of them or all three of them or none of them. So you go through that with each one of them. If it turns out that none of these hypotheses apply to any of your settings, A, I would be very surprised. So if you come up with that conclusion, go back and think about it again. And if it really doesn't, you might think about why. And you might write, instead of just telling me it doesn't apply, tell me how it might apply if things were different. See if you can apply the hypothesis to any of those pairs of settings. Or explain why it doesn't enough so that we understand, that you understand the hypothesis. Okay, so give us enough of your thinking so we will know whether there are problems in our understanding of the hypothesis or particular characteristics of your settings that, that make them unique and make the hypotheses not apply. Okay. They are. Let me make sure I understand what you said. You picked one of the settings.
One of the pairs.
Thank you. I did hear you correctly, but you meant to say one of the pairs and talked about the three hypotheses, 34, 35, 36, as it applied to that pair. That's fine. That's fine. Okay, what do I mean by links between the settings? How are settings linked? All the possible ways. People are the direct links. People go from setting to setting. And in your case, since you're talking about your three settings, you are the primary link. So there's you. There is any other person who goes between those two settings, creating with you a transcontextual dyad. So those are the direct links, you and anybody else who goes between those two settings. And then there are the indirect links, which could be people who know each other and are in a different setting together. So you might have A and B linked because there's somebody who's in A, and Fred doesn't go into B. Okay. Fred is here. So Fred is a direct link between A and C, and with you, Tiffany. He's a transcontextual dyad. But he doesn't go into B, but there's Charlie, and she is in B and C, so she's a direct link between B and C. And A and B are indirectly linked by Fred and Charlie, because Fred and Charlie are both in C. That gets complicated, but it's an important way that A and B are linked. Because you can talk to Fred in two settings, you can talk to Charlie in two settings, they can talk to each other, you can go into B and talk to Charlie about Fred, that's what gossip is about. You can go into A and talk to Fred about Charlie. And thinking about that, you could, since Charlie's a female in this particular case and you're a heterosexual matchmaker, you know them in A and B, and then you find out they're both in C, so what do? You go into A and you tell Fred that Charlie's kind of interesting and interested in him, and then you go into B and you tell Charlie that Fred thinks she's cool, and then they get together in C and they create a relationship and they invite you to the wedding. So those kind of indirect linkages are important.
Is it okay if we are the only links between our settings?
It's okay if you are the only direct link. That's fine. They are settings, they are in your mesosystem, and it's okay for the purposes of the exercise. Then we can talk about whether your settings are richly linked or not, whether you have a sparse mesosystem. Now, the other kinds of links that you want to talk about to finish that thread are, what's the communication between the settings? Intersetting communication is a link. Phone calls? Emails, carrier pigeons. Courier service. What kind of knowledge is there between the two settings? Okay. Intersetting knowledge. And is that linked a lot? Is there a lot of communication back and forth? or again, is there very little? And settings, mesosystems differ depending on the variety of communication, how many people are involved in communication and knowledge, and whether that knowledge is helpful or not, positive or negative, stale or fresh. How okay, so this one doesn't exist. In that case, you have A and B, and you have Fred in one and Charlie in the other. You're in both. How do you describe it?
Like Fred asked, how's Charlie?
Yep. That's fine. It's part of the way the world works. No, if they're not going to meet, it's not an indirect link. An indirect interpersonal link, yes. I'm sorry, ask that again. No, it's probably an important question. I'm probably not understanding, which is, it's okay. The interperson communication is bogging down at my end. So. It may be a form of intersetting knowledge. Because if I'm understanding you correctly, you go into a setting here, it's you and Fred. Fred says, how's Charlie? We're ignoring that this is two different people. Different Fred, different Charlie. Fred knows that you know Charlie in another setting. That's intersetting knowledge that Fred has about your other setting. Okay? And it's one of the ways that we create connections between settings. We tell people about our families. We tell people about what's going on in other settings that we live in, that they'll never be in. And they can create relationships with us or extend those relationships by being interested in those settings that they will never be in, but they know are important to us. Okay? So there's a very important interpersonal connection. It's based on intersetting knowledge that supports a relationship. If, for example, and I've got two examples in my head, I'm trying to choose which one I want to talk about. Think about teaching, and in our overburdened world, the teacher may never go to the child's home, never going to go there, never going to be in that setting. But it makes a difference if the teacher understands what's going on in that setting. And most of us like to be in a setting where somebody knows enough about us to ask about the setting. How's your little brother? How's the new baby? Has your father found work yet? Are your parents helping you with your homework? That's ways of getting intersetting knowledge from the child, from the student, about what's going on in that setting. To the extent that the teacher understands what's going on in that setting, she can be helpful to the child's development in her setting or his setting in the school. Because you can tie the activities that you do to that other setting. Okay. the more you know about a person's other settings, the more inter-setting knowledge there is, the more able you are to make connections for that person in his or her life, in your setting. You can help the student understand his family. You can help the student continue activities that are going on at home, at school, and therefore use the motivation of making that a more complex activity. But you can't do that unless you know about the other setting. I'm sorry? Of a person, an interpersonal link, or an indirect link of intersetting knowledge? Okay. I thought I was giving one. Okay. Mom calls the teacher or sends a note. Little Binky is late for school today because I'm dealing with the fact I just had triplets. And so I hope you'll forgive him. Don't make him stay after school. So that's intersetting communication. Mom has messaged the school. Maybe it's a text message, whatever. Maybe it's in the kid's backpack. But it's intersetting communication. That's indirect. Okay. And always indirect. Our intersetting communication and intersetting knowledge always indirect. That's a very interesting question. And I think they are, I'm quickly reviewing the system. They are typically indirect. They are major forms of indirect knowledge. But I think they are not always indirect, because intersetting knowledge also comes about because of the direct linkages. So if I'm in one setting and I talk about it there, and I talk about myself and I talk about the other setting, I'm providing information within that setting. And then when I go to the next setting and talk there, I'm creating intersetting knowledge, but I'm doing it as a result of a direct link. By itself, after I step out or after I'm removed, then it's indirect between the two settings. So the result is indirect, but the medium may be quite direct, because I'm taking my knowledge and my information and I'm doing the communicating. And that relates to Bronfenbrenner's hypothesis that the effectiveness of intersetting communication varies depending on the directness of the communication. So face-to-face communication, which would be pretty direct, is the most effective. Tiffany?
Do you want us to first describe all the links between each one, or should the links come out that we're talking about?
I would start with describing the links to make sure that you've done that, and then refer to them in the hypotheses when you talk about the hypotheses. I think it's less confusing for the reader if you start with just here are the links that I'm aware of. Now let me see. Thank you for that that question about communication and knowledge. And you wrote that down?
Yes.
Good, thank you. Random access memory. Okay. In this particular exercise, the question is, how much should you quote the hypothesis? You don't need to quote it as long as you give me the number, because that's what I'll be using when we read them. And I will have them in front of me, so I'll be thinking about it. But in describing how it applies, you will need to use the specifics of the hypothesis in order to demonstrate that it fits. Okay, so you will need to use the language of the hypothesis at least enough to make your explanation clear. It's not sufficient to say hypothesis 25 fits. Then I'll have a fit. So you have to explain. So you have to use enough of the language in the hypothesis to make it clear that you're applying that specific hypothesis to this specific situation. Okay. All right. Let's go on and talk more generally about the mesosystem. These questions have obviously been part of our understanding of that. And just to remind you, the mesosystem formally is the interrelationships among two or more settings in which the developing person actively participates. So there is always a direct link, a primary link of the developing person or the person whose mesosystem it is. And then there are, once the two settings have been defined by the person's participation, then there are the other possible links: transcontextual dyads, intersetting communication, intersetting knowledge. And then the whole set of hypotheses about the mesosystem are about the richness of those connections and whether those connections between the settings are supportive of the person's development or not. So all of the hypotheses suggest to us that we look at how these settings are connected, who the people are who connect them for the child or the developing person, how many transcontextual dyads there are, what the intersetting knowledge is, what kind of preparation the person has before he or she moves into the second setting, how many other people go with you, how valid the information is that you have in preparation, how much communication there is after you get there, whether or not the people in one setting support your activities in the second setting, whether the people in the first setting also go into the second setting and enjoy molar activities with you and other people there, whether they have primary dyadic relationships with people in the second setting. It's talking about all the possible ways. His hypotheses are trying to address all the possible ways that the two settings might relate to each other concurrently and over time, and whether what they're doing is supporting your development. So you can think about that larger picture of what these hypotheses are about, and then in order to make his points, he describes minor differences. So as Tiffany pointed out, 34, 35, and 36 are all interconnected, and that will be the case with all of them. The long-term goal for you is not to worry about the specific hypotheses. You need to do that at the beginning. because it gives you all the different combinations and nuances. But the bottom line, the end result that we want you to have is to be thinking about how the settings are connected, what kind of attitude there is between them, what kind of support there is between them, where they fit in the child's world, whether they're richly connected, whether the child has 52 settings that are all supportive of his or her development, or just one, or maybe none, whether there's positive attitude across those different hypotheses, whether people in one know the other one, people in the other one. So we're thinking about the richness, but we need to look at the varieties of richness. How can the settings be connected? But eventually what you're going to want to do is to be able to do, what I want you to be able to do is to think about all the settings in a particular person's life that that person is directly involved with, and then look at the ways they are connected and the ways they support development in a particular direction or don't support it. And then the question will be, how could I change the connections to facilitate the kid's development? How might I change it? What kind of communication could I initiate between the settings? How could I get somebody from one setting to go into another setting to support the child's development? How could I increase the knowledge that people in one setting have about the other setting? And as a parent, those are going to be important questions. Inter-setting communication is good. Inter-setting knowledge is good. I want the teachers to understand my child. I want them to know me. They don't do anything to make that happen. They obviously didn't go to UVM or any other good school. They don't know how to do it. Therefore, I have to do it as a parent. That's my job. Or if they initiated it, I need to respond appropriately to make a richly connected mesosystem for my child that will support my child's development. Okay? So that's what it's about. That's what we want people to be able to do. Okay, so it helps if you have a transcontextual dyad when you first go in. It helps if the role demands are compatible. It helps if everything that you engage in one setting, all the relationships there, support mutual trust between the settings rather than suspicion and fear. We want a positive orientation. We want to agree on the goals for the child. We're all working in the same direction in the mesosystem. We think it's good for people to have lots of different settings, and they need to be varied so that you have the experience of going into settings that are quite different and being able to adapt to them. Where are you going to learn to adapt to new things? Not if you stay home all your life. You're going to learn to adapt, which is a pretty good human skill. We're designed to adapt. That's the value of the brains that we have. How are you going to do that? In Bronfenbrenner's view, you do that by entering a variety of different settings. And the more opportunity you have to do that and to learn new relationships and new activities and to scope out a new setting, the more likely you are to be able to do that, and that means that your view of your world is more valid and it's more differentiated. So it's going to be harder to throw you for a loop if you've had the experience of having a variety of different settings to adapt to. Now, obviously, you can overdo that, and you'll see concern from parents and educators about having kids overscheduled and frantic and they're running from one thing to another, and they really can't extend the molar activities in any of them, and that's not good for a kid. You overwhelm them. Where you're working for as an educator and as a parent or somebody trying to socially engineer the world for kids is to have them be in a particular environment long enough to be able to learn the activities and get good at them and to develop primary relationships, primary dyadic relationships with people there, and think about the setting, and then move to perhaps a different setting, a more complex setting or a structurally different one, and have the opportunity to get comfortable in that setting. And not take them from one to the other and never go back, but to expand the mesosystem by adding settings so that the kid has a variety of things to be involved in. But not so much that the kid can't actually get involved in any of them. So it's a balancing act. You want a mesosystem that is manageable but has a lot of variety. So the kid has the opportunity to learn different molar activities and have different kinds of relationships and play different kinds of roles. And that's what he says in Hypothesis 31. If you've had that kind of experience, then your ability to move into a new setting is greater. Move into that setting and take advantage of it. You're not anxious, you know how to adapt, you know how to have, you have the skills to create interpersonal relationships and make them positive. And that comes with experience. So you need lots of complex experience. I'm skipping over some of these that we already talked about. I just wanted to elaborate on this theme of having a variety of experiences, increasing the number of new experiences and the kinds of new experiences that you can learn from. And it helps if there are lots of supportive links. That's Hypothesis 35. And 36 says it helps if those supportive links are people with whom you have a primary dyadic relationship. And if they engage in primary dyadic relationships with other people in the settings that you're in. So you're creating, ideally, a web of primary dyadic relationships across your mesosystem so that you have primary dyadic relationships in several different settings with the same people and they have primary dyadic relationships with each other. So they're thinking about each other when you're not there, and that's going to support your development. And all of this business about having supportive links has a limit, as he suggests in 37. And I think I said last week that you reach a point when you're comfortable enough in your mesosystem and you can manage it pretty much on your own, when the next step in development is to be able to stretch yourself. So it may become a good idea not to have all those transcontextual dyads. It may be important to move into a setting where there aren't going to be supportive links. Stick your feet in a setting that is unprecedented, that is quite different from where you've been before, that none of your family are going to go into, you're not going to go there with friends, and thrive. That's a different level of adaptation. It says, I can go someplace where I don't know anybody, and I don't speak the language, and they do things very differently, And now I'm going to stretch my understanding of the world by seeing if I can fit in, if I can figure this out, I can avoid getting in deep doo-doo. I'm going to come into this new kind of setting. And if I do that and I'm successful in it and I develop relationships and I learn to cope and I become comfortable in that setting, I can say, yes! I went to Bulgaria on my own and I can do it. And if you reach that point, then you can have confidence that you can do that in another unprecedented setting, the situation that you know even less about. What that is giving you is the confidence in your skills to adapt to very unusual situations. There's a danger in that one that it might suggest the John Wayne approach to life. You know, I'm the cowboy on my own. I don't need anybody. I don't have ties to anything. That's not what he's suggesting. What Bronfenbrenner is suggesting that you have your mesosystem and it's rich and supportive, and you can go into new settings, but that doesn't mean leaving everything else behind. It means going into those new settings, adding them to your mesosystem, and therefore enriching your whole mesosystem. It doesn't mean riding off into the sunset without the woman, without your sidekick, nothing but your horse and your rifle, and feeling like you own the world. That's pathological when people do that. We're supposed to keep our mesosystems, and they're supposed to stay rich, and we keep our relationships. That's one of the ones in the exercise, I think. Are there indirect linkages between settings that encourage the growth of mutual trust, positive orientation, goal consensus, and a balance of power responsive to action in behalf of the developing person? Do you know somebody in one of your settings who knows somebody in another setting that you're going into or are in, and will they encourage connection and trust and goal consensus? Will they look out for you? It's what happens when, well, let me give you an example. My wife was worried about her daughter heading off to Costa Rica several years ago with a friend, transcontextual dyad. That was okay. But they were young. So they didn't know anybody in Costa Rica. But it turns out that the friend had a relative who had a resort, and they were going to try to spend a little time there. And he was very gracious, so there was an indirect connection. And I pulled out thinking, aha, this is a Hispanic culture he's in. And family and parental responsibility are really, really important. Therefore, he will understand if I email him and essentially tell him that we're really happy that these young women are traveling and we hope that they will at least watch out for them and make sure they call home and let us know where they are. And he did understand that. It is a paternal thing in Hispanic cultures, and he understood that, and so he did. And what that meant was we had the indirect link, okay, and intersetting communication between us that said, okay, I'm not going to interfere in the traveler's world, except that we share a goal of keeping them safe and encouraging them to call home. Okay. So that was goal consensus. He agreed with us, and they did. Okay. And there was trust. He knew that we knew that they were going to be near him and that therefore, if they called him or stopped in, he should respond positively to that because there had been this indirect communication. It wasn't intrusive enough to be controlling parent. It was connection enough to relieve her mother's anxiety. Because I could say to her when she began to get anxious, that's all right, Señor, he'll call us if there's any problem. They can always call him. That's mutual trust. Okay? And it helped people in both settings and the travelers to have that. Positive orientation. We know they're going to have a great time in Costa Rica, especially if they go to this part of Costa Rica and get in touch with these people. We're really talking about the mesosystem and the orientation of people in both settings toward the travelers. And we obviously are very concerned about them and happy for them to have this wonderful adventure and to expand their world, which they did. And later they went to Argentina and Chile and slept with the goats on a farm and, you know, all those wonderful things. But they had had that experience in Costa Rica first. So the positive orientation was Señor knew that he was supposed to respond positively if these kids got in touch with him. And they did. And he did. And the positive orientation was that he knew that behind them, back in Vermont, were caring parents who knew how to make that communication work and not say to him, okay, buddy, you got to take care of these kids when they come. We expect you to do. That wouldn't have worked. So by doing it in a reasonably sensitive way, I thought, he was able to say, okay, here are concerned parents. I can understand that. I have kids too. So I'll watch out for them. And I don't know what he did, but he may have alerted everybody in the village to watch for these two kids. I don't know what he did, but they had no difficulty in that part of Costa Rica at all that they told us about. And hey, if they didn't tell us about it, I'm happy with it. Okay. So, yeah, thank you. That's a nice example from my own Echo autobiography. Balance of power responsive to action on behalf of... we didn't direct things. The travelers had the power. We didn't exercise any power. We just provided information. We didn't encourage their potential host in Costa Rica to take any power away from them to keep them from having their own adventures or making their own decisions. We just set him up to be responsive positively. But we kept the balance of power in their hands. The power really was in their hands. They didn't have to get in touch with him, and if they did, we didn't suggest to him that he make them stay at his house or feed them or anything except encourage them to call home, but not to make them call home. So we were encouraging the power to stay in their hands where it was. Okay, the easier and the more extended two-way communication is between the settings, the better it's going to be for the person, most likely. And if we're thinking about children or other people, it helps if family are part of the communication system. So, for example, when the federal government created the Education for People with Disabilities Act many years ago, they built into the regulations for education of people with handicaps, they built into that the schools, the special educators, medical facilities, anybody involved with the child is required to communicate directly with the family and to involve the family in any decision making about the education of a handicapped child. Simple. Except it hadn't been done before. When I was growing up, schools made decisions about handicapped kids and what was going to happen to them and then told the parents what the decisions were. They didn't involve the parents necessarily. And Bronfen Brenner and others know that if you're going to have a kid living in a family, and the family is the parents particularly are the people who are most concerned about the child's development, you'd better include them in the communication, and it better be two-way. Don't tell them what you're going to do for their kid. Let them tell you what they want you to do for their kid. And that is the law. And if you're going to have an individual education plan, individualized education plan for a handicapped kid or a kid with special needs, the parents are going to sign off on that after they participate in its development. And it makes life a lot better for the parents and for people with disabilities. And it helps if you have those communications in face-to-face meetings. So you can actually talk to the parents, actually see the parents, and they can see you. It keeps you accountable. But if you can't do that, then it needs to be a personal letter, telephone, something that is tailored to the individual rather than an announcement or an email that goes to everybody's email list. It's personalized. It helps if the information you get is pertinent, so you understand the setting before you go into it, orientation. And it helps if there is continuing communication between settings. Not just, okay, your kid can come here, we're never going to talk to you again, just send your checks. But we'd like you to know something about what's going on with your child. Now, if you take all those primary dyads over time, and you think about a mesosystem where everybody's connected to everybody else, Bronfen Brenner suggests that there are situations where it might be helpful to have a group of people with whom you travel to a group of settings on a regular basis, and he calls that a closed activity network. And as I suggest in the book, closed in this case is not bad. It means that we have this group of people who go from place to place with each other. They all have primary dyadic relations. They all engage in the same activities. And they do this over time. And the value of that is that they can talk about each of the settings. And if two of the people are parents, or three of them are parents, and two or three of them are kids, and maybe one of them is your child's best friend, and you're going to school and you're going to church and you're going to Disney World and you're going on vacation to the beach and you're going to the movies and you're going shopping and you're doing those things as a group, then you have lots to talk about. And you're fulfilling the conditions of all of those other hypotheses of having primary dyadic relationships, interlocking web of relationships, lots of knowledge about the different settings because you have a lot of transcontextual dyads. That's what a family does. What some families do. You go places with your parents, and then they talk about the places that you've been, and you rehearse the stories, and you construct your understanding of the world based on those shared experiences. Or, in college, you have a group of friends, and you do several things together. You go downtown and get wasted. No, you don't do that. You do good. You go to the library. You go to lectures. You go to concerts. You go to class. You participate in intramurals. What that does is allow you to build those relationships and talk about how you behave in each of those settings, or how what goes on in the library is connected to what goes on in class. And that increases, improves your understanding of the world and makes the relationship stronger. If you don't have those joint activities with anybody, the settings are not connected. And eventually, after you understand all those settings, and think about time. Now, I'm not thinking about the time that we only... That clock is a minute fast, but we're going to live by it. I get credit for that. Think about settings over the course of time in which you do activities that are similar over months or years. See if you can think of for yourself a set of settings that you have been in over time, one and then adding another one and then maybe moving to a different one and moving on, that in this particular case create a pattern of motivation and activity. Many of you described molar activities that had been carried on across several different settings across many different years. Some of you started playing hockey when you were two, and you've been in a lot of different rinks, and you've played in a lot of different leagues on a lot of different teams. That's a developmental trajectory. And you love hockey. Maybe you rode horses. Maybe you danced. Most of us have school as a developmental trajectory. We've not been at the same school all of our lives. We've been in a variety of them. Okay. They create a developmental trajectory. This is just another setting. Some of you are going to continue it. You're going to go to graduate school. Some of you are going to continue it by recycling and becoming teachers. You're going to stay in schools. And the developmental trajectory got started way back, preschool or childcare. And Bronfenbrenner is then setting us up to look at the relationships between those settings over time as we move from one to the other, and that's what we'll talk about on Wednesday. Thank you.